What I've done first is write a bunch of words on the board. The words in red, the first four especially, are very important to figure importantly in a quotation from H.H. Price. We're about to look at and also in a quotation from C.I. Lewis we're about to look at. The next two figure, if you just read a little further in either direction, in either book. So here are words that these two texts have in common. It's a little bit of a question just how to put the category which all these words fall into. But for lack of a better thing to say for that, let's call it all philosophical terminology. By that I don't mean that you can't find in the dictionary, an ordinary dictionary, or that your grandmother might never use some of these words. She certainly will use the word thing and the word present. She will say, that thing was not present when I left this house. But what makes it philosophical terminology is that when philosophers use it, it's functioning a certain register. These words deployed in a certain kind of a sentence. Anything present to the mind is such that you don't actually have to know how that sentence finishes to know you're reading philosophy. It's not a quotation from grandma saying what she saw in the house. So these words, deployed the right way, express philosophy. You will find them in philosophical treatises by people as different as Kant, Husserl, Heidegger, Sellers, Bertrand Russell, Gottlob Frege, Ludwig Wittgenstein, and people in this department and people in my department. So, philosophical terminology. Here's terminology that actually functions, that actually occurs in the very limited selection from Price and Lewis that we'll look at just to constrain what we're looking at. Thing, sometimes it's about material thing. Present, to emphasize what they mean, they'll say directly present. That which is directly present to the mind is such that. Consciousness, directly present to consciousness, they might say. Given, that which is predictably. Directly present to consciousness, I will call the given epistemic. It has a special epistemic status, such phenomena. Still haven't completed a sentence, but I managed to use all these words quite easily. These are words that actually occur. They are related. They're, as it were, in their philosophical employment, their use is cognate, or conceptually, internally related, to lots of other expressions that also occur in Price and Lewis, and lots of other authors. So the notion of a thing, you could also have the notion of an object, objective, we want knowledge or thought that is capable of being of objects, or in touch with objects. The question of whether there is such a character that attaches to a particular thought or not can be taken to be a question of objectivity. Similarly for these other words, that which is present could be called a presentation that might either be contrasted with or taken to be a species of the genus representation. Focusing on this aspect of the issue, that which is directly present, philosophers will often speak about what is immediately present. Hegel will begin by worrying about that which is immediate and be described as a great foe of immediacy. Locke and Hume think more is immediate than can be. So that which is direct is contrasted with that which is indirect. What are we directly in touch with? What do we know? Not simply in virtue of what we're directly in touch with. So the immediate is contrasted with the mediate. Philosophers will say things like intuitions are mediate concepts, are mediate or mediated. So what is mediated? So these words immediately are connected to other philosophical terminology. Other examples are on the board. So all of these words, and I hope it's clear, I can make this list a lot longer. This is just a sample that comes immediately out of these passages. But I could give you much other terminology which functions a certain way in a philosophical register. And then what I want to say about this terminology we have on the board, but much else that's immediately related. So you can't stop with these words. These words immediately start yielding other words. What I want to say about this philosophical terminology to begin with is just the following, which is whether it's functioning in, and now I'm building on the last three classes, whether it's functioning in a Cartesian register or a Kantian register makes all of the difference to how it works, what it means, what the philosophical issue is. So one thing this means, which I'll show you hopefully already by next class when we look at Putnam and McDowell, is you can have philosophers who will say the very same thing. They all utter the same sentence, but they're not talking about the same thing. Because one of them is construing the issue in Cartesian terms and one of them in Kantian terms. Putnam says, coming attraction, Putnam says he agrees with McDowell that it's a great mistake to think our cognitive powers cannot be directly in touch with the things themselves. That's the crucial mistake. The crucial mistake is to think that our cognitive powers are only indirectly in touch with the things themselves. McDowell wants to say something like that, but he wants to say to Putnam, but the thing I want to say is completely different than the thing you want to say, even though our words are the same. I mean, Putnam, McDowell doesn't get to the point of putting the issue that way, but he says, you've completely misunderstood me. I'm saying part of the reason he's misunderstood him is, though they both want to utter the same sentence, one of them's talking about a Cartesian issue, one of them's talking about a Kantian issue. But to see that, we need to see how this vocabulary itself can function differently. So what we're doing now, basically, is we started by just contrasting the Cartesian and Kantian problematic in very broad terms, just with some examples. Last class, we tried to come up with some features so we could distinguish these things a little more carefully. Now we're bringing the helicopter even further down. And we really want to look at a concrete example in philosophy of perception of a philosopher working through a Cartesian problematic in philosophy of perception. And another philosopher, exactly contemporary, across the ocean, in America rather than England. I don't think it matters too much for these purposes. Either one could have been in either place. Worrying about a Kantian problematic. And therefore actually worrying about something, a philosophical issue that has taken on a different shape. And what I want to show you is how this same vocabulary recurs, but it's doing a different kind of work. It's very easy to read these two philosophers and think they're talking about the same thing. I think one reason Kant and Wittgenstein and Heidegger, to take three examples, are often misunderstood, is because people pick up sentences that can be given a Cartesian reading and assume that they are raising an issue that fits into a Cartesian problematic, when at least in those sentences, that's not what they're talking about. So this is where actually being able to see how these things function differently matters. So what we want to do now is look at this in a bit of detail. It's worth noticing just superficially how deep the similarities go. So the two passages that you have on the first page of your handout from Price and Lewis. Price's book is called Perception. Lewis's book is called Mind and the World Order. But the first few chapters are about a topic he's happy to call perception. The first chapter of Price's book is called The Given. The second chapter of Lewis's book is called The Given. These quotations are from those chapters with the same title. I could go on. But superficially, as you go on like that, you think, this is certainly the same issue, same words. Now what I'm going to say is that the Price quotation is concerned with a classically Cartesian problem. I mean, in a way, all he's trying to do here is reformulate the problematic of the first meditation in a contemporary idiom. The Lewis quotation, I'm going to say, is concerned with formulating what he takes to be a Kantian issue about problematic. So Lewis, too, I think, takes himself to be reformulating Kant as he understands him in a contemporary idiom. And that's, in fact, true of his whole book, Mind and the World Order. I think it's an attempt, basically, to rewrite the Critique of Pure Reason for the then-modern American reader of circa 1930. But I want to say that the resulting problematics from each of these philosophies, I think, understand the issue they're trying to talk about respectively quite clearly, are very different. I think the Lewis is much easier to get a grip on. If you've taken any philosophy courses, it's clear what the issue, and I'm sorry, in the I think the price. Don't listen to what I say. Listen to what I mean. I think the issue in the price, I hope I'm not doing that too often, is much clearer and easier to get a hold of. It's a familiar philosophical issue. We'll go through it quickly, but I don't think you'll have too much trouble understanding it. The issue in the Lewis is someone I think is a pretty good reader of Kant. I think it's a lot easier for people to mistake, to fail to see what the distinctively Kantian problematic is, to turn it back into something that has a Cartesian form. So what we're going to do mostly today is talk about the Lewis, talk about the chapter which leads up to this quotation, try to get clear about it. And then at the end of today, contrast the price and the Lewis and see really how different they are, despite their superficial similarities. So that's the goal for today. But let's first start by just reading the price, so we're familiar with it. When I see a tomato, there is much that I can doubt. This is essentially an attempt to re-perform the investigation of the first meditation. It's not a fireplace this time. It's a tomato. We've got the tomato. There's much that I can doubt. So notice we've got a generic object, as I was calling it last class. A tomato. Not a special kind of tomato, a tomato. It doesn't say how far away the tomato is or what the lighting conditions are, but we understand the tomato is sort of right about here. There's no problem seeing it. So we don't want to get into questions about Price's eyesight or questions about whether it's a sweet, granny, delicious tomato from Southern California. The issue is, what can I know in virtue of my senses? So the tomato is, in this sense, what I was calling a best case. And the issue then is doubt. Again, next step in our Cartesian features. We want to now see, given that we have a certain presentation, what is susceptible of doubt and what isn't? And that's essentially the topic of this paragraph. We're going in and sifting our experience, placing it under more rigorous philosophical scrutiny than grandma usually does, and seeing what bends to the most rigorous philosophical doubt, and what, even in the face of that doubt, cannot be made to bend. So we start doubting. Well, here's a thing I can doubt. I can doubt whether it's a tomato that I'm seeing or not a cleverly painted piece of wax. This goes by quickly. But notice that if you understand this, you understand that you're being given something here that has the structure of what I was calling in the previous classes the argument from illusion. That is, the cleverly painted piece of wax is irrelevant if it's a decoy duck or even a wax model of a lemon rather than a tomato. We understand the cleverly painted piece of wax is something that's made to look like a tomato. And at that distance, in this lighting, you might mistake for a tomato. So that the worry is, yes, this, I would conclude here there's a tomato, but I might possibly be in a situation that's sensuously indistinguishable from this one. And yet, the basis for my claim that I'm a tomato is such that I am mistaken. And it's not a tomato. It happens quickly, but he's relying on this epistemological background for us to understand the point of the example of the cleverly painted piece of wax. So there's something, it is insinuating a doubt that it's actually a physical tomato beyond how things appear to me. That can be doubted. And the doubt has been insinuated in one sentence like that, given a certain philosophical background, through an implicit presupposition of the argument from illusion, an argument from indistinguishable cases, such that I cannot tell. Therefore, I cannot conclude it's a, we might say, real tomato. And the doubt goes further, really fast too, because he assumes you've already read some philosophy. I can doubt whether there is any material thing there at all. So I might be dreaming. I might be hallucinating. There might, 6 inches away from me, not even not be a wax tomato. There might be nothing but empty air. I'm lying in bed. You know, unless there happens to be a mosquito hovering. So, very quickly, giving way to the doubt, building on a tradition of philosophy, is anything which is material, outer, beyond how things appear to me. Perhaps what I took for a tomato was really a reflection. Perhaps I'm the victim of some hallucination. So these are different ways of insinuating argument from illusion. He doesn't go the dreaming route. He goes the reflection route or the hallucination route. But they serve the same purpose. If I were in a state of hallucinating a tomato, the assumption is it's a really good and gripping hallucination. From within, I wouldn't be able to tell the difference. So, first few sentences are saying what does yield to doubt. Then, what doesn't yield to doubt? Here's one thing I cannot doubt. That there exists a red patch of round and somewhat bulgy shape, standing out from the background of other color patches, and having a certain visual depth. And this whole field of color is directly present to my consciousness. This is his complicated way of trying to bring out, and what he takes to be a phenomenologically gripping matter, that there is a field of appearance. Descartes, would have said, sensory ideas. There is something, as it were, within the realm of res cogitans, or in the mind, that I can't doubt, that things appear a certain way. And here he's spelling out the appearance, that it has a certain bulgy red shape. What it signifies, as he goes on to say, is a further matter. But that is present to my consciousness. So here, what is present to my consciousness, what is directly present to my consciousness, is being summed up as a complicated phrase for that which I cannot doubt. Any claim I want to make based on that, about what there is beyond my consciousness, that the first few sentences have tried to suggest, is vulnerable to doubt. What the red patch is, whether a substance, a state of a substance, an event, whether it's physical or psychical or neither, these are questions we may doubt about. He's not saying at the moment, he's not a skeptic. Price is the end of the day like everybody else at this time in philosophy. He's trying to answer the skeptic. But, he's initially raising the issue, and he's going to give us a complicated story, which hasn't found many adherents, about how we can conclude, based on what we sense, that we know certain things. But initially, he's conceding that there looks like there's room for doubt here. So we can doubt, what the character of what's beyond the fleshy red bulge, psychical, physical, and so forth, that we can all doubt. It's, as Cartesian philosophers will say, its ontological character can be doubted. Its phenomenological character is just given. That there is something red and round, then and there, I cannot doubt, he says. Whether the something persists even for a moment before or after is present to my consciousness. So present to my consciousness is being understood in this way that is temporally self-contained, as well as spatially self-contained. So he thinks as soon as something's in the past, it's no longer present. So even that is dubable. I think a way of thinking that's hard to resist once you yield to other Cartesian premises. Whether other minds can be conscious of it as well may be doubted. And as we saw, whether there even are other minds, something that can be doubted. But that it now exists, that I am conscious of it, by me at least who am conscious of it, by me who at this moment am conscious of it, that cannot be doubted. This is a way of fleshing out the substance of Descartes' cogito with respect to this particular presentation. When I say that it's directly present to my consciousness, I mean that being conscious of it is not reached by inference, nor by any other intellectual process. We might say it is not mediated in any way. Requires no further thought or inference. I just have it there before me, now, presently. Where the implication here is, all of the stuff in this paragraph we've said can be doubted, can only be known given an additional inference. Given that it seems to me right now that there's a tomato. given that my eyesight is fine, that I'm fairly reliable, there's no reason to think I'm dreaming. It seems reasonable to conclude that there is a... That looks like an inferential step beyond what's given. And then what the skeptic always does is try to problematize the inference. So there's a picture here of what's given and all other knowledge, if it is to be able to live up to its credentials of knowledge, involves an inference, and the question is, how do we validate the inference? Descartes tries to bring in a God who would not deceive us, who we also know must exist. That turned out not to be, in the history of philosophy, a way of going that most people thought was all that reassuring. But the basic structure of the problem Lewis has several hundred years later isn't that different. He's trying to get by some other route what Descartes was trying to get through his God, namely a way of underwriting the inference from what is indubitable to that which it sure the hell looks like we ought to be able to say we can know, but it looks like there's room for doubt. So how do we answer the doubt? It's not reached by inference, nor by any other intellectual process, if it's directly given. This peculiar and ultimate manner of being present to consciousness is called being given. That which is thus present is called a datum. So this whole paragraph is an explanation of what he means by the given. He's telling us what this word means in philosophy, for him and for others who are interested in this issue. It's the first paragraph of a chapter called the given. It's the first paragraph of the book, actually. So we haven't read much Price, but we've gotten a few lines in, and we see that he's first trying to teach us this word so we can learn what the book's about and what the issue is. So one of the things I'm going to show you is there's no less important word in Lewis than this word. You know, when famously Wilfred Sellers is talking about the myth of the given, the philosopher he's most concerned to criticize is Lewis, who was his teacher. But you misunderstand Sellers if you think he's just attacking Price. Many people do. So you understand Sellers is fundamental problematic, like Lewis is a Kantian. So we want to see what this word means in Lewis. And a question that will ultimately be interesting, but we can't discuss now, is are these people just all writing really badly? Why is this a problem? Why do I have to put all these words on the board and say, but they could be working this one register or this other register? You know, why couldn't Lewis have used a different word than Freud? Why couldn't have all the Cartesians gotten their act together and used one set of vocabulary, and all the Kantians, and then we wouldn't have this problem? Are they just really inobservant, and so they've created this horrible problem? Or, you know, assuming there's something right about the fact that this vocabulary wanders, or what is the deeper underlying systematic cause of this wobble? That will be a question we should be interested in. But first, let's see if the phenomena, the textual phenomena themselves are, as I said. So, I think the Price is fairly straightforward in terms of what the philosophical issue is. It's a straightforward instance of a Cartesian problematic in perception. It's mostly here for purposes of comparison with the Lewis. We'll come back to it, mostly so we can see how the Lewis differs from it at the end of the class. Now let's talk about Lewis. I'm not going to even read the Lewis passage yet. I don't think we're ready for it. But they're both there so that you can go home and in the privacy of your bathroom or someplace else where you have some time, you can read the two through. Both see how in a quick read they can sound really similar. And then also see if you can learn to get the philosophical melody of each of these ways of philosophy into your ear profoundly enough so that you can really schematize these passages as having a very different kind of logic in terms of what the question is. That's really the task here. So that's why those two quotations are there. There's a way of learning to pull these passages apart that I ultimately want you to do, which is a kind of issue of how you schematize the philosophical text you read. So let's try to understand Lewis. What I have here is lots of quotations from Lewis now. Looking at my watch and seeing that I've already spent 40 minutes saying almost nothing about Lewis, so we cannot afford to start at the beginning. Let's start with your assignment. Your assignment's chapter 2, so I'll take mostly quotations from chapter 2. The first whole lot of quotations are from chapter 1. If you'd be interested, I only assigned chapter 2. If you'd be interested in either chapter 1 or chapter 3 of the book, so you just get a slightly larger taste of how this is working, beyond the immediate comparison with Lewis, I or Rickard or Cato have PDFs of both those chapters. Send us an email. We can just send them to you for copyright reasons. we could include them in the reader. But we're willing to break the law privately. So let's start with quotation 23. It is an error common to rationalism and to pure empiricism that both attempt an impossible separation of something called the mind from something else called experience. He takes himself here to be summarizing a fundamental Kantian thought. Putting in a slightly closer to the language, the critique of pure reason, you might put it this way. It's a common error of both rationalism and empiricism, and Kant might have added, both dogmatism and skepticism, to attempt an impossible separation of something called sensibility from something else called understanding. I guess I should have put those words in a different order for this quotation, the opposite order. That's sort of closer to the text. But there's a thought here that's a Kantian thought, which he's trying to reformulate. Now, what that thought is itself, I think, a matter about which there can be much debate. That is, this too is a form of words that philosophers can understand very differently. If you tried to get it slightly clearer, I think the following is true of most philosophers who think of themselves as Kantians in the philosophy of perception. And then there's analogous, as it were, Kantian views in all kinds of other areas of philosophy. Wherever there's one of those gaps that I talked about in the first two classes, you can substitute the two sides of the gap in for this formulation I'm about to give you. And you've got a Kantian view about another issue, about action, about other minds, and so forth. But with respect to conception, I'm sorry, with respect to perception, what I'll call generically Kantian thought goes like this. There are two independent sources of perceptual knowledge. A passive source of perceptual knowledge, which we could call sensibility or intuition, or Lewis here, experience, and an active source of perceptual knowledge, which we could call understanding or something else. What does he call it? The mind. Each of which is necessary, and neither of which is a sufficient condition of knowledge. There's what I'm calling a generically Kantian thought. And then one of the things I'll try to show you quickly along the way today is that can be understood in incredibly different ways. There are very different views that could be understood as Kantian in that sense. But all will pay lip service to that dictum, so put. And therefore various quotations in Kant, like intuitions are blind, understanding, concepts are empty, what else? So one question will be what this means. And that would also raise a question about which of these possible ways of fleshing out this generic schema is Kant's own. Should I say something else about that? No, better not. Keep going. So, impossible separation. So both the rationalists and the empiricists make the same mistake. The empiricists think, first we start with the impressions. That already gives us a kind of knowledge. And then we refine it and build up. The rationalists start by thinking, we have these innate ideas. Already, a disembodied being, without any perceptual knowledge, has certain fundamental true beliefs, has certain clear and distinct ideas. But then, you know, we can supplement this and enrich this with empirical content, and that helps us know certain kinds of things. But both beings take there to be a fundamental paradigm of knowledge. In the case of the empiricist, sensibility, as it were, allowing itself to have the world impress itself on our sensible faculties. And that already gives us impressions that are of things. It already gives us some kind of representational content. And then more needs to happen before we have knowledge. The understanding comes in, but the understanding comes in to process, supplement, and enrich something that already fundamentally involves representation of the world. Rationalists think, no. First of all, we have these different kinds of rationalists, but if you're Descartes, these divinely implanted, clear and distinct ideas. Those that we've been given those right off, 2 plus 2 equals 4, that is a truth which we can know in virtue of how we are created and the kinds of minds we have. Those will only get us thus far. That's a paradigm knowledge, mathematical knowledge often for the rationalists. Now that needs to be supplemented and enriched, and we need to bring in the senses and so forth, you know, to have a full edifice of physics. But the fundamental capacity for representing truths, for entertaining thoughts that are true of something, already comes with the structure of our mind. Kantians are going to say, I think this is true, it's so abstract, says almost nothing, but this I think is true. Kantians, if they're really Kantians of any interesting thought, are going to think both sides have made a common mistake. Both sides think that one of these faculties, in isolation from the other, has the resources to deliver something that we can think of as cognition or representation or experience or thought. All of those forms of cognitive achievement require a certain kind of cooperation of the faculty that in each case is being privileged. So the empiricists and the rationalists are arguing with each other. They think whether they're innate ideas or something like that's a really important issue. They've missed the boat. The important issue is this fundamental separation. As we'll see in a minute, that's not to agree on very much. You can be a Kantian in incredibly different ways, having said that little. I've said very little, actually, but it might sound like a lot. Seeing how little it is, I think, will be important. What we have now in Lewis, but I'm not going to spend the time on it, but I just sort of direct you back to these quotations. These are from the end of the first chapter, which is why you might want to ask Richard to send it to you. Is we have him saying, you know, what specifically the mistake in rationalism and empiricism is. This in quotations 24 through 28. 24 through 29, and how each is the mirror image of the other. Certainly something in Kant he's getting right here. So he's going to think that Locke and Hume and Descartes and Malebranche have a similar kind of problem, which is due to this impossible separation. So the whole Kantian inquiry starts from a place where we're trying to clarify this common mistake that all of these people operating in the Cartesian register are making. That's the assumption of a Kantian. As we'll see, very different kinds of Kantians. But that much, I think, is part of what it is to be Kantian in an interesting way. Which isn't to say some readers of Kant don't read Kant as being still having a Cartesian problem. I'm not denying that about some. I'm not trying to capture all the commentators. Putting some demanding content into what it is to be a Kantian. So Lewis is going to claim against the mistake of the empiricist, the mistake of the rationalist that you have in quotations 24 through 29. In quotation 30, towards the very end of chapter 1, the world of experience is not given in experience. So now Lewis is using the word given. And he's using it differently. Much we will see that Price will say is given. Lewis is going to say isn't given. Price is going to say that red bulgy shape, that's part of what's given. Lewis, as a Kantian, is going to say red, bulgy, those are concepts. You couldn't even perceive something as red or bulgy if the understanding wasn't in play also. What is given is what your senses deliver apart from any exercise of the mind or the intellect. So what is given is less than Lewis thinks. Though he's describing the world of experience. The world of experience itself isn't just given. The world of experience is not given experience. It is constructed by thought from the data of sense. So here we have the word data again, which goes with this. But the data of sense is less than the world of experience. It involves a moment of construction that Price, as a more classical empiricist, has skipped. This reality, which everyone knows, reflects the structure of human intelligence as much as it does the nature of the independently given sensory content. So Lewis wants to insist there is something for the words independently given sensory content to mean. But to figure out, as it were, what it stands for, it's much more difficult than it is for Lewis. It's not a matter of just opening your eyes and saying, it's that. Because it's all shot through with the contribution of the mind. We need to first, now I'm tempted to say, separate that which the mind contributes from that which sensibility contributes in order to isolate that which is independent of the mind. But did he just say a few quotations ago back in 23 that the mistake of the empiricists and the rationalists is they both try to perform this impossible separation? So we need to understand Lewis in a way that's not, so he's not contradicting each other. He says independently given. That independently has to be consistent with the mistake all the other guys make being one of impossible separation. It's very easy when you first pick up Lewis to think, this doesn't hang together. But I think if it doesn't hang together, it's not a stupid mistake. It's a very subtle mistake. So Lewis is aware of the problem I'm trying to raise here. And we will come to it. This is maybe a good moment to distinguish. Well, is it? Yeah, this is a good moment maybe to start to distinguish kinds of Kantians. I gave you that generically Kantian thought. Sensibility, understanding, these are both conditions of knowledge. Neither is sufficient, both are necessary. I said there's a lot of ways to understand that. So let's look at some different ways of understanding that thought. They're independent of each other. What does that mean? Well, one thing independent could mean is temporally independent. Something happens first, something happens second. First stuff comes in. Something impinges on my sense. And then I bring it under concepts. So I might think there's an order here, but the order of description or explanation actually reflects a temporal order of process. So first I have an array of sense. There it is. Then the concepts come in and organize everything. It's like first you have a dirty room, then you clean it up and you have a neat room. First I have dirty sensory experience, then I bring in the concepts and I make it shiny. So independent could mean temporally independent. If you think it's temporally independent, there's still a lot of ways to go. One view you could have is, and if we look hard enough, if we know how to do phenomenology properly, we can, as it were, strip the concepts away and get at, as it were, the mere sense data themselves, which are then conceptualized. So these two stages, these two temporal stages that are independent, are, as it were, both part of our apperceptible consciousness. We can separate. I don't think hardly anyone thinks we're aware of first seeing this as a mere field of sense, and then we blink and, oh, now I see. It's a magic marker. I mean, almost every philosopher will say we see it immediately as a magic marker. That's because we've gotten so good at conceptualization. They might say in certain cases. But the more interesting question is whether they think you can, as it were, isolate through a certain kind of introspection an element of sense as independent from an element of consciousness. So a kind of Kantian will say yes. You could think that these processes are temporally independent. Still, you could share that assumption, but not think that. So you could think, no, the phase where all of this happens is a kind of cognitive processing. So by the time we reach apperceptive consciousness, we always have conceptually structured manifolds. But first, somewhere, you know, before consciousness, we got stuff that was a sensory manifold, and then concepts came in, but we can't recover that. Such people who like this reading of Kant think Kant is the father of cognitive science. Module 1, sensibility. Module 2, understanding. So that's one way to understand independent. Another way to understand independent is not to think that these are temporally independent moments, but to think that they're logically independent. That is, it must be possible to distinguish in any cognitive achievement a contribution of sense and a contribution of understanding. It doesn't mean that as a matter of temporal unfolding, first we have all and only one, and then we have the joining of the B team to get the performance to then complete it. But in the order of analysis, we must, whenever we have a being that can cognize, be able to explain his achievement by being able to see there is both a contribution by each of these things. So such a person could insist that experience itself is unified, but insist nonetheless there must be these separate contributions. And if we didn't have both of them, then we would not have knowledge. We wouldn't have a capacity for representation. We wouldn't have a capacity for sensory consciousness of an object, and so forth. That's a second way you can understand my dictum. What I'm saying so far, the dictum is neutral. Saying intuitions and blind and concepts are empty doesn't tell you whether first the one comes and then the other comes, or if it's telling you you need both, but you can't necessarily separate them. It certainly doesn't tell you if you think they're temporally distinct, whether they're both introspectively distinct. Yet another way to understand the dictum, I think you can see there's a progression here in the ways of reading Kant. Yet another way to understand it would be from quotation 31. So actually, let's look at 30 for a minute. In quotation 30, you have Lewis arguing against the first way of understanding what the Kantian doctrine should be. So he doesn't think that the datum, our philosophical study, is a blooming, buzzing confusion on which the infant first opens his eyes. Not the thin experience of immediate sensation, but the thick experience of everyday life. So you might have a kind of being who is only capable of what he calls thin experience here. Experience that is in no way conceptually ordered. But he doesn't think that what thick experience is a temporal unfolding of thin experience plus something. I guess that's not that clear from this quotation, but if you read the book, we'll see from other quotations, he clearly is rejecting that kind of separability. He's insisting that what we're describing when we describe experience properly is, in his sense, thick. It is a unity. In this respect, his phenomenology, I suppose, agrees with Husserl's, if you will. But now, quotation 31 is from Kassir. I think Kassir is actually a rather different kind of Kantian than Lewis. Kassir here is saying, I'm not going to read the whole quotation and go through it, but he wants to say there are all these things that we need to distinguish, and Kant does distinguish when he's doing philosophy, sensibility and understanding, the universal and the particular. But he wants to say we don't understand what he's doing unless we understand these as moments in a single unity. That is, aspects or elements that mutually determine one another. So Lewis, Kassir, on his reading of Kant, is going to deny that we can even see these things in the order of explanation as being utterly distinct. The thing we should mean by sensibility, if we're talking about something, it's a kind of faculty, is a kind of sensuous awareness that only a being with concepts have. It's not the thing the child has plus concepts. The thing the child has is not yet a kind of cognitive faculty. And similarly the other way. So that he wants to say we haven't even identified the right kind of elements unless we understand those elements as themselves already involve a certain kind of mutual cooperation. So these are moments, aspects, abstractables but not extractables. To quote that's something that Gilbert Ryle says in a very different context about philosophy of language. But as you've already seen me say, the issues in philosophy of language are not that different than the issues here. Philosophy of language issue is, are sentences made out of words? There's an issue. Or do the words only mean what they mean in the context of a sentence? And there's different kinds of views you could have about independence, and whether it's temporal, or whether it's explanatory, or whether you have a certain kind of holism, you can't have the one without the other. Kant didn't think about that issue, but there is a Cartesian versus a Kantian, or if you will, an atomist versus a holist issue about that, which has the same structure, the one in perception. So Kassir has a view in which it would not be right to say, as Lewis does in the bit I've underlined in the previous quotation, that that which is given is independently given, is independent the contribution of the mind. Kassir, in this respect, has, if you will, this is just a piece of jargon, it can be misunderstood, but has a more holistic reading of Kant than Lewis does. Lewis is in the middle with respect to these three kinds of Kantians. There's many more than three, but I just gave you three where Lewis was to the right of one and the left of the other to help you locate Lewis. We're trying to understand now. So Lewis does think that it's important to retain a sense of givenness. The senses make a contribution. What comes through senses is given. Is not spontaneous or active like that which is contributed to mind. But it is independent. But the sense of independence is still not a Cartesian one. I also gave you some quotations from Schlick on your handout, which I was going to spend some time on, but I think I'll skip them also. But the point of the handout, the quotations from Schlick, is that he's a good example of the first kind of Kantian, rather than the third kind of Kantian. Schlick, also in the essay I'm quoting from, is, you know, explicitly invoking Kantian vocabulary. He is, at this point in his career, it's before he's become, well, he is explicitly participating in a certain neo-Kantian tradition in German-speaking philosophy. He's using words even like intuition and concept. But it's important for Schlick that there is that which is just there in experience. There is the blue of the sky. Schlick will use quotation marks when he talks about the blue of the sky. There is blue in quotation marks and nothing else. The reason he uses blue in quotation marks is without quotation marks, he admits that that describes something you can only experience if it's sorted with respect to the concept blue. It's good Kantian. He knows that our experience is conceptual structure. But he doesn't want to talk about that which you only perceive once you have the concept blue. He wants to talk about that which is the basis of your application of the concept blue. The blue. That which you can't yet call blue because you haven't got the concept blue, which is the basis of your applying the concept blue when you see something as blue. Once you've learned to distinguish blue from red, from green, from yellow, and so forth. And what Schlick actually says, you can't talk about this. He's trying to talk about it by saying things like the blue. But he says, all expression involves conceptualization. So anyway, we have a describing experience brings in concepts. But Schlick thinks there's something you can direct yourself to, which you can see is just there, which is, Schlick would call the given, which is unconceptualized experience. Lewis will say, different kind of Kantian, you can't do that. Our experience is thick. But he'll say, Lewis is wrong about the nature of experience. What kind of argument is this? They're all arguing about what you cannot help but admit if you just look. But they have very different views about this. Interesting feature of this kind of philosophical argument. They all think the Cartesians or the Persians or the Priceans are wrong about this. So there's something they all agree about too. Lewis thinks if you just look, you've already got concepts involved. He thinks Schlick is right that there must be an independent contribution from sense, which is that which is, if you will, merely given. But he doesn't think we can isolate it from experience. So, at least not isolate it that way. The quotation, which we have paired here with the Price quotation, the beginning of the handout, is his attempt to show us how to do what we can do isolated. That's what the quotation's about. Kassirer thinks they're both wrong. There is nothing which is independent in that sense. There is a unity which we can characterize a certain way and see has these mutually determining moments. But neither moment could be the moment it is. Nothing could have the aspect of sensory consciousness of an object without contribution of concepts. Nothing could be a substantive concept without sensibility. So in Kassirer's reading, intuitions without concepts are blind, concepts without intuitions are empty. But Kassirer would say, what is a blind intuition? It's not a kind of an intuition. Any more than a blind person has a kind of sight. They got other senses. They ain't got sight. And an empty concept isn't a kind of a concept. A concept has to distinguish some things from other things. If everything or nothing falls under it, it's not a concept. If I try to teach you Blick, but it turns out everything is Blick, or nothing's Blick. I haven't taught you an empty concept. I haven't taught you anything, says Kassirer. Lewis is in the middle here. Seeing that people are going to want to be in the middle is part of seeing why Kantianism is a difficult matter. Lewis is going to look over at Schlick and think, this is still too Cartesian. This is falling back into the problems of empiricism. You haven't understood Kant's critique of impossible separation. If you just think you can open your eyes and have sensibility apart from understanding, you just think it's two temporal stages given like that. But he looks over at Lewis, he looks over at a reading of Kant like Kassirer's, And he thinks, that's what he will call vicious idealism. Here, thought has been disconnected from sensibility. We need what comes in from the world to be independent of the mind in some way, or we don't really have knowledge. So a certain kind of characteristic Kantian mind is very different from the Cartesian mind, where one's trying to tell a certain kind of story. But the worry here isn't, is what seems to be there really there? The worry is, given that our sensory experiences has a certain kind of character, how can that be? And in the how can that be story, one's teetering between a view where one has what some philosophers have called a mythical version of the given. The given is given properties that it can't have on its own. Or one falls into a kind of idealism where one has nothing that's given. But then one no longer has a story in which one understands how one's thought or consciousness or experience or claims are answerable to something outside the mind. That's the character of what the words realism and idealism stand for here. The question is not one of here's how things seem, but what kind of objects are there? The issue is, what is it for our thought or experience to have content, empirical content? And can we do this with the conception of the given that avoids being both mythical and ultimately only appearing to a kind of coherence or consistency that's empty? Can we avoid blindness and emptiness at the same time? That's the structure of the Kantian problem. We'll say more about this after the break. See you in 10 minutes.